91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we're at your service with lots of information for those interested in estate planning, wills, and probate. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper here. We'll visit with elder law attorney David Salonim, who'll take calls about many topics. One aspect of estate planning is rather new: detaching the deceased from online sites, including social media. We'll hear how this situation is best handled. There are many other questions, as well as decisions to be made: how to get the process started, deciding how your estate should be distributed, and more. Again, we're at your service, and we'll take many of your calls. Stay tuned to learn more. First, NPR and regional news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman off again today. She'll be back soon. So this hour, we're at your service about an important responsibility, which is a frequent area of procrastination. There are some tough options if one dallies too long. We refer to, of course, estate planning. We have Melbourne, Florida-based attorney David Salonim on hand. He's the co-founder of the Salonim Law Firm, PA, and he'll take questions at 800-743-9576. Welcome to you, attorney David Salonim.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be here.
Welcome to Topical Currents. Before we begin, of course, our standard disclaimer. Attorney David Salonim is in no way purports to give specific legal advice to callers or emailers, but is only using his expertise to give general information. David, when should estate planning for the average person begin, and why?
Well, that's a good question, but it should be really any time you're over the age of 18. I'd say that...
You never know.
You do never know.
You never know.
So, you know, just as an example, you're aware of living wills. And, you know, living wills have been around for quite a while, but people think that that's something that's only for, you know, somebody more senior. But all the U.S. Supreme Court cases have been for women under the ages of 40. So, you know, that's Terry Schiavo and several other cases like that. So, you know, a power of attorney, a healthcare surrogate, a living will, those are the advanced directives usually that we tell people are even more important than just a last will and testament or trust, because you want to make sure that somebody's making decisions for you if you're just incapacitated. Most people don't really care that much about their assets per se after they die. They're more interested in what happens while they're alive but incapacitated, and everything go around with that. So I always recommend that, you know, that can be done as soon as you can. And I've even told clients that come to me and they have younger children, you know, it's a great holiday present, for example, is, you know, to buy that sort of thing for their kids, because it's really a lifetime investment there.
So if you don't act on estate planning, you really lose control over what happens after your death.
You do. That's the whole point of that. So estate planning after death, you're looking at the last will and testament, for example, handling those, you know, assets, distribution. And, you know, that's kind of the point now where we're starting to see a change in how that is happening, where we're dealing with, you know, typical tangible assets, your car, your house, and your typical intangibles like your bank accounts and other things that will be distributed. If you don't have a last will then or a trust, then some of those things can be distributed in a way you don't want. Nowadays, actually, you know, we used to tell people that you should look at your loved one's mailbox, for example, for new statements to come in to know that what the accounts are. And nowadays, you know, I tell people look in their email as well, because that's just as important to see where those utilities and other statements would be coming in.
Well, let's touch on this rather new area of digital estate planning. And how it works.
Sure. So part of my practice area is digital estate management. And we also have a separate company called Estate Pass, which basically helps terminate online accounts for people after they've passed away. Because the digital assets, if you, you know, look at your phone right now and you wake up, you look at your email, or, you know, you go on Facebook, or you save an account, a file to your Dropbox account, or, you know, all these things, these are as tangible in a way as some of the other things. And it's important to be able to safeguard the data after you pass away or incapacitated. And the Florida legislature actually has found this to be equally important. And they just have passed a law that is going to be in effect in July that is going to require online service providers to have certain tools in place to allow for prior consent. And so everybody's powers of attorney and last will and testaments should also refer to digital assets to allow that person that they named to administer their life while they're alive through the power of attorney.
So, or you could have that, if you already have an estate planning document, you could have that added as a codicil.
Well, yeah, for a will, a codicil, usually we just update the documents. It's just as easy to do that entirely. And powers of attorney should have special language in there giving prior consent to somebody. And so that's a really big thing right now that we're seeing. And the big corporations, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, all these companies are really involved with the legislation in that.
Attorney David Slonim, give us a couple of examples of how somebody can really be in a mess by not having digital estate planning.
So, you know, when, as I mentioned before, so much of our present information is online. So let's say, you know, let's say you take pictures of your grandkids or whatnot. Most of the time you're doing that on your phone. Right. So that's not a tangible thing anymore. That's being saved either to your phone or to some cloud service. And so if anybody wants those pictures after you die, then they can't get access to them because it's your account. And so there needs to be in place a method to have somebody have access to that. And the service providers have to have in their user service agreements language that permits that sort of thing. And so, for example, if you have a Netflix account and it's your account, but it may be a joint credit card with your spouse, and so you die, your Netflix account then is only accessible technically by you, even though your spouse may have your password, she'd be accessing it illegally according to federal law. So that's where all of this really starts to come into play. So there's so many different aspects of this that people just don't even think about. And we just use it during our daily lives now without the awareness of what happens when a person dies. So, you know, in my practice, people come to me usually for doing estate planning and advanced directives planning. And they leave feeling like there's so much better off after the words because they've done that planning. And nowadays, you know, we include the digital estate planning as part of that.
A lot of people wouldn't even be aware of it. How about an example if, say, I'm a fairly prolific blogger and have a large audience, maybe and generate some income, mm-hmm. and I die suddenly, what happens to that blog and who's in charge of it?
That just is in stasis, potentially forever. So so then, you know, nobody may have access to that technically under the end user license agreements. Then, you know, there needs to be a way to either access or close that account. And the intellectual property that's generated from all that blogging is also something that needs to be dealt with proper estate planning tools.
What if I printed out all my usernames and passwords and gave them to a loved one and say, you know, if I die, here's how you close up my Facebook and
right.
And that.
So people,
of course,
you know,
somebody
think
could
that
get
that
access
fine.
To that.
Right, right. I agree, Joe. So, you know, that's something that a lot of people do, but they, of course, one of the tenets of the law is that ignorance of the law is no defense. And so while in practically speaking terms, it's not going to be a real issue, legally, there's two federal laws that actually make that illegal for
a husband to close out
a
wife's Facebook
right,
account.
Because they're not technically the account owners, and the end user license agreements and the federal laws prohibit that.
Well, how about then the firm that you have? That has permission from the user of the account for it to be closed upon his or her death.
Right, that's right. So basically, the technical term is prior consent. And so if the end user gives prior consent for this other person to access, then you're in a better position there.
Now, let's tread on online banking. Mm-hmm. How does it apply there?
Well, online banking is a little different because that's tied to your bank account. So in legal terms, what you're really dealing with is having your personal representative. If you've passed away, the person's going to then be able to access that once they become your representative. Or if you're incapacitated, then you've got the power of attorney that's going to name an agent to access that account. So that's dealt with traditional estate planning means. Typically.
Run that by again. That's important, though. If I have online banking when I die, how will the online facet of that account be closed? And then those assets would go into my estate and be distributed to whomever I've designated.
Well, usually, yeah. So, with estate planning methods, you can certainly have a will that says that your assets in your bank are going to be distributed to a variety of people. What you can also do with the bank is have what's called a POD, or payable on death, and that is going to automatically distribute the assets once they provide a death certificate to the bank. So there's different ways of distribution.
So that's prearranged with the bank.
That's prearranged
that,
with the bank.
John Doe will get the contents of this account, and it doesn't even have to go in as part of the will?
That's right. That's outside
so
of the
other,
will.
So the other relatives or something, there's like a really real family squabble down the road
could,
there.
Well, yeah, it could be. Now, here's where the real myth that I try to overcome is very often, is that elderly parents of kids will say, oh, well, I want my child to be on the account with me to help pay bills, for example. If something happens to me, then I'm going to have my son or daughter on the account. Now, the problem with that is twofold. First off, if the parent were to die, then that account is entirely the child's.
Right.
And it also creates a problem where if that child was sued or some other creditor came after that child, there's no line in that bank account that says that what is a parent's and what's a child's. So what I do to overcome this is to use a power of attorney document to then allow the child to be named as a person's agent. So if you're incapacitated, then the child could then use that document to do the very same thing without incurring the potential creditor issues, liability issues, or either the estate planning issues if the intention was not to have everything just go directly to that child.
What if someone doesn't have a spouse or anyone particularly close to them, and they set up a joint account with, say, a nephew or grandson who they think has a good business head on their shoulders, and they make a joint account, say, I want you to handle my affairs for my burial, outstanding bills, and that to close out. Maybe they come from out of town.
Right. Well, again, the same issues are going to apply. You still have the potential liabilities for financial concerns and whatnot. So just use a power of attorney to do that for while the person's alive but incapacitated, and then have the person, if they have no family and everything would go to this extended family member like a nephew, then just have the POD set up for the account to go to them after they pass away.
Now, if somebody wants more information about digital estate planning, what's a good source for that?
Well, it is a fairly new topic overall. So there's of course, my website, slonimlaw.com. Or
S-L-O-N-I-M.
Right, that's my law firm site. Or they can go to estatepass.com, E-S-T-A-T-E, pass, one word, where they can get some information about some of that as well. There's, like I said, it's fairly new, so I don't know of any singular site or reference material that they could find.
It's Topical Currents at your service. We'll take a short break and be back with more. Mm-hmm. 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're speaking with Melbourne, Florida-based attorney David Slonim. He's the principal of the Slonim Law Firm, PA. And we're taking questions. If you'd like to join in, 800-743-9576. Also, email, if you're a little shy, radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. First caller from Coconut Creek, this is Danielle. Hello there, go ahead.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Good.
I have an issue in that my ex-husband passed away while on vacation overseas. He had placed my oldest son, who was not his natural born son, as executor of the estate. And then we had two children. My son is 28. He has taken it upon himself to latch onto the box of papers with all the documentation in it. We have no idea if my ex-husband had a life insurance policy that my children need to cash. He had the foresight to purchase a property for my daughter, and he placed that in a trust so it would be protected. But everything else is in limbo right now. Because my oldest son, that was his son as well, who was not named executor of the estate, he's just like sitting on this material, and we can't extract that from him. My daughter, who's 22 and has a good relationship with him, she says, well, every time I bring it up, he gets very, very agitated. And my big concern is that he is doing things that are not necessarily legal. He used to live, my ex, in an over 55 community where he is going to be evicted for sure. He hasn't even told them that my ex has passed away. My other
Danielle, this is getting very complicated for the radio. Perhaps David can give you just a little overview from what he's heard so far.
That'd be great. And just a lead as to where I should go for, further counseling on this.
Well, Danielle, I'm glad that you called. I'd say that the first thing you really need to do is potentially have a local attorney review this with you and see what can be done. Now, did I understand correctly that there was no probate that's been filed, or has that
is correct.
Okay,
that
so,
is correct.
You know, if your son-in-law, is that correct?
No, my son.
Okay, your son has that box, but he's not sharing that.
Correct.
Then I would say that you can actually file for probate yourself.
Okay.
And become the representative to then force the issue. The will, of course, does nominate somebody to become a personal representative. But if that's not being utilized, then you can just force that and have what's called an intestate probate that's going to at least give you the authority to go further.
Okay. All right. So and that would just give me the power to go in there and see what's in the box.
That's
so,
right.
So you'll need your own counsel.
Right. Okay.
All
right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. David, we promised to be talking about elder estates. So give us a brief discussion of guardianship and why it's important and how sometimes you can get into trouble there where a lot of fees that just kind of slowly drain accounts.
So, a guardianship is really the nuclear option when it comes to helping somebody manage their life, because if a person doesn't have their advance directives done, that's the power of attorney, healthcare surrogate, or even living will, then if they become incapacitated for whatever reason through any Alzheimer's or dementia issues or even accident, stroke, whatever, then if there's no documents in place, those advance directives, then there's somebody that has to manage your medical needs, your legal and financial needs, and a guardianship is then the only way to do that under Florida law. And it's very expensive. Normally, on average, it's approximately about $10,000 to actually get a guardianship going, so it's really not cheap in any way.
So there has to be some assets there to work with.
Well, you know, it depends. If a person's indigent, then there's reduced costs along the line, and the state helps cover some of those costs, but it is expensive for the family to start a guardianship if there is a family. And then, of course, it's time consuming because depending on the kind of guardianship that you've got to enter into, if it's an emergency or if it's a typical plenary guardianship, and I know we're getting a little technical in the terms, but the problem is that you know, if it's a long-term guardianship, it's going to be months and months of just dealing with waiting for the courts and get everything ready to get that in place. And then there's just a lot of general problems if you don't have those basic documents done first. So guardianship is kind of the last effort because it removes your personal rights and gives somebody else, just like a parent of a minor child, the authority to do things on your behalf. So the courts take that very seriously.
Many in our listening audience may have a situation where perhaps an elderly parent is living in Florida and children are out of state. Perhaps the parent is in an assisted living facility or has a private caretaker. How can those people best know that their loved one is being taken care of? And also perhaps if they have suspicion that there might be some abuse going on or illegalities.
Well, you know, worst case scenario, if there is suspicion of abuse, they can certainly contact.
That's a criminal act.
Well, it can be. And so you can contact the Department of Children and Family Services, and there's an anonymous elder law or elder helpline, rather, that they can call, and then DCF has to investigate that within 24 hours. And so it's kind of useful to be able to have that tool if you felt that there was a real concern there. Otherwise, if a person has family out of state, then and they're declining in their capabilities, then the family can also hire a case manager to help manage the person's services and whatnot.
Let's go back to our calls. Again, our email is radio@wlrn.org and telephone 1-800-743-9576. Next up, it's Frank in Kendall. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Joe. Thank you for taking the call. So my question has to do with a trust and some directives that I had created a while back. I own a small business, and I sought the services of an attorney that prepared, I guess, the standard four documents, and also a fifth one, I think, called an ILIT. And I named, you know, certain beneficiaries in there, and it was what they call, I guess, an irrevocable trust. And I now need to make changes to those beneficiaries, either by changing the percentages or, removing one altogether. And I was told that because it's an irrevocable trust, I can't remove them. So I just wanted to see what your view is on it, if that's the case.
Well, an ILIT, for those that aren't kind of in the game, is an irrevocable life insurance trust. And so that is generally used for some different benefits planning purposes, usually for some tax planning purposes as well, you have a small business. So it's an irrevocable trust, meaning that it can't be revoked by you, for example. However, there may be some clauses in the trust. You may want to go back to the attorney that drafted it or to another attorney and see what the amendment clauses could be. And sometimes it would require a court to actually revise it if that's the case. So there may be some kind of openings for amendment to change the beneficiaries. Usually within the document, it's going to dictate the mechanics of that.
Okay, well, great. I appreciate the answer. And this topic is so on point because I literally just placed a call to him yesterday and I left a message. So I'm just waiting on his call back, but I wanted to get your take on it. So thank you very much. Thank you, Joe.
Sure, Frank.
Okay. Thanks for your call again. 800-743-9576. Attorney David Salonim, so many times perhaps a friend or family member dies and people are together and they start discussing wills. And it seems surprising how many people say, you know, I really need to get on that sometime. I need to make some decisions. And yet they never do. No one wants to be facing their own death. But if you don't do that, you can really get into some situations perhaps where people are making decisions about your health care if you're incapacitated that you don't even know.
Right. So if you don't have any decisions stated in any documents, then it's going to be up to the state to make those decisions.
And a doctor can't be it.
No. And so when I say up to the state has basically defaults that basically is going to dictate who's going to make medical decisions. And, you know, it's called a healthcare proxy. And so in a healthcare proxy, the first person on that list that's under the statute is not a spouse. It's the guardian. So if there's a guardian, they have the right first right. And then it goes down to a spouse, and then children are next in that list. And anytime you're naming multiple people on, let's say there's multiple children, for example, then you're kind of doing it in a way that requires a
family conference.
Well, it does.
Maybe a
it
battle.
Does require, you know, everybody to work together. And so the problem is that most families just don't. You know, there's a lot of good, loving families out there, but there's quite a few that will have conflict. And so, you know, you're setting yourself up for conflict if you don't have those documents in place.
So if you have children, you should probably think, who's the most level-headed of my kids? And we'll make the best decisions and not be overly emotional about it and be practical and yet also have my best interest in heart.
And, you know, what we've done, and I don't know how many other, you know, attorneys out there have done this as well, but when you have family members who are out of state, we've put into our healthcare surrogate documents an emergency temporary surrogate. So basically, somebody that's local, I like to say boots on the ground, so that way they can interact until the other family member comes in, and then you have an opportunity to kind of switch over. But at least there's always somebody that's around to make those kinds of decisions.
Right. It's Topical Currents at your service. We'll take a short break and be back with more and more calls. Past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition, at your service with Melbourne, Florida-based attorney David Slonim. And we're talking about estate planning. He's an expert in elder law. We'll go back to the phones. We've also been discussing the area of digital estate planning, and we'll have a summation of that because it is new information before we go off the air during this hour. Next up, it's Jason in Miami. Jason, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I have a very complicated story, and I'll try to condense it.
Please do.
I'm an active-duty military guy. My family is all out on the West Coast. My aunt, who's got a large estate, the estate was a victim of elder abuse. I went back out there, fixed everything, but now I'm the power of attorney for financial and in her estate planning. The problem becomes is half, she's a widow without children, half of the estate goes back to the other family when she passes. The problem is that the other point of contact, the other financial POA, and the lawyer are involved in the other estate, if that makes sense. So for me, I feel like there's a conflict of interest. Should I lobby with my aunt to get a separate attorney so that he's not covering both estates? And is it inappropriate for someone to be a POA for both sides, if that makes sense?
So I'm just trying to make sure that I understand the question. So you're the POA for your aunt, who's a widow, and then there's another attorney who's the POA for, I guess, your aunt's deceased spouse?
My aunt's attorney, he's not the POA, but a cousin, my cousin, step-cousin, was the son of her past husband, if that makes sense.
Right.
And so I love whatever, it's all great, but there is somewhat of a conflict of interest where when she passes, half of her huge estate goes back to the other side, the other family.
Well, first off, the power of attorney ends at death, so
okay.
You know, that's really not going to be a continued issue unless we've got a trust or the will that's going to have you and your cousin as co-PRs or trustees on that issue there.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, did we answer it then?
Well, that was easy enough.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, and we'll move along to Judy in Delray Beach. Judy, hi.
Yes, hi. Great topic. You know, I'm in a situation where my dad was left as the executor of the will, and the two nieces in New York are the benefactors of a lot of cash, but my father was left the main beneficiary of all his cash, and he's to execute the will. He's very forgetful, and another family member has taken on getting a lawyer from up there and, you know, saying that it's 7 months before anything is going to be done. Meanwhile, my dad has checks from the two nieces for thousands of dollars, and they don't know what to do with it. And I'm trying to tell them to establish an estate account and just cash the checks because they'll be voided after 90 days and, you know, just be proactive. He's got to know what's going on instead of having the other family member just take it out of his hands, and he's known to lose money for everybody in the family. Mm.
Judy, sounds like there's an interesting family dynamic here, to
say
the least. So if your dad is the executor in a will, and I guess the person that he's executor of has already died, right? So we're dealing with this. So the will basically is the instruction manual for probate. So unless that has actually been probated yet, then you know, if there's another person on the list as the, in Florida it's called personal representative, to act on this person's behalf, then maybe that other person may be a better choice than your dad, unless there's, you know, some other concerns about that secondary person. And as far as the checks go, that can only be really deposited into an estate account. And you can have the companies reissue the checks if you go beyond the 90 days. So I'm
can a regular bank do an estate opening?
No, like if well, he goes, once the estate is actually opened and then a person is nominated, and the court will issue orders or letters appointing that person to be the representative or executor, then they will be able to create a bank account for the estate and the checks can be deposited, but not before then, usually.
Oh, boy. Well, they said something about 7 months.
Usually not.
New York.
Yeah, I mean, usually you can actually get somebody to be appointed as a personal representative or executor within a couple months, usually, of opening the whole probate administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just hard to get information from him. And like I said, the other family member isn't trustworthy with money.
Well, definitely, you know, if this is all happening, if the person that died is in New York, then you'll definitely have to talk to an attorney in New York.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank
Good luck.
You.
Sure.
Okay, thanks
all
for
right.
the call.
Bye-bye.
David Salonim, what happens about outstanding bills of the deceased if the number of bills outdistance the amount of the estate? Can heirs be held responsible for those debts?
Thankfully, your debts die with you for the most part. So heirs are almost never held responsible for that unless they're on a joint credit card or joint account where they may have some co-responsibility there. So let's take a recent situation that's occurred. A person goes into a nursing home, and then the state, through Medicaid, pays for the nursing home care, and the person has maybe $100,000 in certain other assets that are exempt for Medicaid purposes. But when the person dies, then they're no longer exempt from creditors. And so then the agency that's handling all the Medicaid stuff basically files a claim against the estate, in this case, for over $200,000. And so the claim is more than what the assets are. So then the state will reduce that once they know what the assets are. But then those assets, once sold, will then go to pay for the claim. So if you're talking about a
house.
Not
the creditors.
Well, the creditors is the claim. So the creditors file the claim.
Right.
But to answer your question simply, the family does not have to pay the debts of the deceased there. So only the estate, if it has any assets, to pay creditors, if the creditors are within a certain claim period and whatnot. There's a lot of other legally complicated matters there. But most of the time, like I said, the family does not have to worry about paying any of the debts there.
This is even if there's a huge credit card run-up debt.
Right, right, yeah.
That you didn't know about. Mm-hmm. So, uh-oh, look what Grandpa's been doing. Let's see, our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. Email, radio@wlrn.org. And this is Lisa in...
Yes, I'm here.
Lisa in Port St. Lucie. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I had moved to Texas in 2010 and earned more money than we had ever before, although we're modest wage earners, and so we had our will, all the documents drawn up in Texas. I lost my job, then my husband lost his job, and we moved back to Florida, and we haven't really financially gotten back on our feet. The documents, I haven't been able to afford to have them redone in Florida to conform to Florida law, and I want to know, are they valuable? Are they legal in the state of Florida?
Lisa, you're in luck. The United States Constitution has your back on that. So,
good. Is this like, you know, interstate commerce or something?
Well, it's called the Full Faith and Credit Clause.
Yeah.
And so what that does is that basically any document that's done in one state is given the full faith and credit of, you know, for that state to another state. The catch is, of course, that every state has their own little tweaks to the documents and the way they like to have them done. So while that document is perfectly valid in Florida, for example, that you did in Texas, you will eventually want to talk to a estate planning attorney just to review the differences there, because if something were to happen to your husband and you needed to use a power of attorney, for example, on to help him out in any way, sometimes there would be some issues that go along with that. But usually
okay.
you're in good shape.
I just want to tell you that he had a major heart attack 3.5 weeks ago, and
right.
he's going to survive.
I'm pleased to hear
which
that.
Is he's really very fortunate, having had a second heart attack. We have no assets. I don't own a house. I own 2 jalopy cars. I have no money in the bank. There's no life insurance. I'm kind of like at a loss for being at our age and being so financially unstable. So I guess I'm asking, I don't even know what I'm asking, to be honest.
Well, I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks
okay.
for calling, Lisa.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's Topical Currents. We'll take a short break and be right back. We're back. It's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper. We're having one of our At Your Service editions. Bonnie Berman should be returning soon. She's a little under the weather, and we look forward to that. We resume our conversation about estate planning and elder law. We have Melbourne, Florida-based attorney David Slonim on hand. He's the principal of the Slonim Law Firm, PA. David, before we run out of time with all our callers, how about some contact information for you?
Sure. If they need to get a hold of me, the easiest way is to call my office at 321-757-5701. And the website is Slonim Law, one word, S-L-O-N-I-M .com. And, of course, if they want to cover any digital estate matters, then we've got Estate Pass, Estate and Pass, one word.
In fact, before we get into another flurry of calls, how about giving us another brief primer in case people have tuned in late about this aspect of digital estate planning, which very few people even consider.
Right. So, you know, we deal with our digital estates in a way that, we deal with, you know, our other tangible property in that, you know, under present situations, if it's under Florida law, it's coming out, in fact, your digital assets are going to have to get probated or handled in the same way unless you have another person that you have given prior consent. So digital assets, what is that, right? You think about, oh, is that a money thing? Is it like a PayPal account? Well, a digital asset is anything like your Facebook account, your social media in general, or even your Dropbox or your Flickr account or your Target account, you know, or your Netflix account or Amazon. All of these things are your assets, that you own this account to the extent that it's, you know, whatever's in it is your property, unless the end user license agreement says otherwise. But then when you pass away or incapacitated, then there's nobody else to have who is given the authority to access this account. And so now things are changing with the digital estates and the, you know, documents I mentioned before, the will, the trust, the advanced directives like power of attorney, all should have special language in there covering digital assets and your online life in general.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Bill in Lake Worth. Hey there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a Florida trust set up in 2004 and dated 2004, and I heard that it is maybe not good or needs to be updated. Has something changed?
Well, you know, the various statutes do get updated every once in a while. A few years ago, the trust statute got updated. But most of the time, if you had one done earlier than the recent updates for the trust code, it's still going to be grandfathered in. And of course, you know, I couldn't tell you what's good or bad about your trust. However, an estate planning attorney or elder law attorney would be able to review that and tell you. But it's going to still be fine for most cases as long as you've properly funded it and handled that.
It was very simple trust, just so that things were passed properly. But, okay, great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, and we speed along to Naomi in Miami.
Yes.
You're up, Naomi.
Yes. I just have a question. If I am, I was named as a beneficiary in an insurance from a person that just passed away, and I want to transfer that benefit to the guardian. How do I do that?
Okay, so you mentioned the benefit. You want to transfer this benefit to a guardian? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Who's the guardian for what?
A friend of mine that died last month. She didn't have anybody really, and I couldn't help her for some reasons that I already explained to the other person. But I just want to transfer the benefit to that person, to the guardian.
Okay.
She was a stranger. She was a person that was just going door to door, doing some campaigning, and that's how she found her.
Well, you can certainly do one of two things. You can receive the funds, depending on the amount that they are, not really have too many major issues with that, and then just gift it to the other person. Depending on the whatever, if there's a probate or some other method of transfer there, then you can have some sort of altering of your interest in beneficiary to this other person there.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. And we have an emailer, Topical Currents. Can you tell me about the, quote, ladybird deed and how that can work?
So a ladybird deed is actually something that came about with Ladybird Johnson. So what it does is basically gives a way, it's a to transfer real estate to family members.
That's how she got rid of the TV stations, right?
It's possible, yeah. To family members without necessarily having a probate to transfer the real estate. It also gives so that's normally known as a life estate deed. So a ladybird deed is what's known as an advanced life estate deed or enhanced life estate deed, because it allows the person that retains the life estate to then be able to sell the real estate as part of the process there. Otherwise, they don't have the authority as a typical life estate deed to then sell the property. Only the remainder men that are in the deed does. So again, this is a fairly complicated deed. I wouldn't recommend that anybody just go to a paralegal group or something. This is something that a proper attorney should be drafting there.
I suppose some people put off making their will because of decisions they have to make, say, concerning family and who should get what, and should I cut so-and-so out, or should I take compensate because so-and-so stayed with me and helped me for years when I was sick, and that. How should they address that? Just kind of go with your gut as you feel that day and make the will?
Well, you know, a will can be changed anytime you want to change it, so long as you have capacity. I think the worst thing you can do is doing nothing, right? So I like to say that failing to plan is planning to fail. So, you know, if you don't do anything, then it's going to be just up to the typical statutory methods to transfer those assets after you pass away. And so, if that
and
occurs,
also you can really incite a major family rift and squabble.
Well, yeah, if that's, I mean, you can do that willingly if you wanted to through your will.
Let them battle it out.
You get the last laugh, right? So that's one way. But, you know, if you don't want just, you know, any heirs at law just to get it, then you should have a will that's done so you can direct how that's going to go.
And we'll take another caller. We're very short on time. Frank, Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yeah, how are you doing? Yeah, parents both passed away the last couple of years. They're American citizens living abroad, but they had some savings in a U.S. Bank account. Just wondering, real quick, who should I contact? Do we have to have a probate set up for that in order to distribute the funds to all beneficiaries, the three siblings? And if so, do I contact an attorney in this country that they live in the state the funds are in, and how long would that take, probate?
Okay, so, you know, it sounds like your parents both died abroad. If it was a joint bank account, then the second person that died would then have to have a probate done for that account, if that account had no beneficiary designation, which it sounds like it did not. What you'll have to get is a death certificate from that country that they were living in, and then have it translated, if it's not in English, by somebody called an apostle at the U.S. Embassy in that country. Then you can bring that back to the States and then have it probated here, for example, to get that bank account transferred. So there's a process for that.
Okay. And how long would that take, usually probate, once it's set up?
How long is it going to take? Well, typical probate, you know, for just a bank account like this would probably not be overly long once you get all the documentation in place. So you're probably looking at about 6 to 9 months on average.
6 to 9 months. Okay, perfect.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
David Sloan, and for those of who have been lucky enough to not have to go through a lot of this, tell us about the importance of getting a lot of death certificates upon the death of a loved one, because there are a lot of things you probably haven't thought of that will require that.
Well, yeah. Interestingly, you know, the Florida courts now are going all electric, or electronic rather. So,
So that's easier now.
So, you know, we still have to take in a short form, meaning that it does not have the cause of death on there, but we don't even have to send in the original death certificate to the courts anymore, but we still need to see it and scan it and send it to the courts. But most people should get about 5 to 10 short form death certificates, and then a couple long form. And again, the long form has the cause of death on there, and that's mostly for life insurance and other purposes.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with attorney David Sloanum. He's the principal of the Sloanum Law Firm, PA. Thank you very much, David. We hit you from a lot of angles this afternoon, but thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
And thanks for joining in this afternoon. Our lead producer is Richard Ives. Associate producer is Polly Landis. Technical direction provided by online producer Paul Deary. And as always, it's easy to access free audio archives to pass along to others or to listen again. Just hit our website, that's WLRN.org. Follow the radio link. Also, information, pictures, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's Topical Currents begins with a feature on this year's Night Cities Challenge grants for the Miami area. Also, chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer with the latest information on smart green kitchen design, either new or existing. Joseph Cooper here. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.